Welcome to another episode of Naval History and Heritage Command's Anchored in History, Stories of America's Navy. I'm your host, Cliff Davis, and today with me co-hosting is Petty Officer First Class Abigail Lutz, and our guest in the studio is Dr. Heather Haley, historian of the History Advisory Group here at NHHC. So, Abigail, would you like to start it off here with some questions, and we'll take it from there?
Thanks, Cliff. Before we get into this episode's topic on women's naval history, I'd like to thank Dr. Heather Haley for joining us. So thank you so much for being here. Can you tell us a little bit about your role at NHHC?
Sure. Thank you for having me on. This is very exciting. I am a historian with, as Cliff mentioned, with the Naval History and Heritage Command. I received my PhD from Auburn University in history. I also have a certification in public history, and my research interests specifically center on the social movements of the 1970s. So you're going to hear a lot of that today, for better or worse. And then we'll kind of get up into the present as well. And for my position here at the yard, I am a historian. So I kind of dip my toe in all sorts of histories, whether it's operational. When I first started working here in August of 2022, my supervisor asked me to do a series on Guadalcanal, and I am a social historian. So that was fun. So, but I do also get to, you know, answer questions from the fleet that come to us. So it really does truly broaden my understanding of how the Navy operates. So I tell everyone I love my job.
Awesome. Well, it's great that you love your job. And what's your favorite part about your job?
Favorite part of my job, truly digging into the records that we have here on the yard. Our archives is in the process of moving, so we're going to open up to civilians here hopefully within the next 12 months. However, just being able to just, you know, touch documents that were preserved from the personal papers from Admiral Zumwalt. There were also some letters in there that involved his wife, which I thought was really interesting. So there could be any number of things. So I would say that's probably the part of my job that I love the most, is digging into records.
That's really neat. Thank you. And so today we're going to get into some of the women in naval history.
So why do you think studying women's history is so important to not only just the Navy, but to the public at large?
Because women are such an integral part of the Navy at present, there are currently serving civilian and active duty, and that history is a recent history. You know, since the existence of the Navy, women have only served for a very short portion of that. And the services, in my opinion, generally try to emulate or reflect, better word, reflect the population at large. And so having women's history just even spoken about, discussed, having panel discussions, how can the past inform the present with the same concerns and issues, no matter how small.
Yeah, so you kind of talked about how in the Navy, women's history reflects societal, mm-hmm. you know, history, things that are going on. Can you kind of speak about how women's experiences in the Navy intersect with broader societal shifts and movements, such as feminism and women's rights?
Absolutely. One of my research interests is on this very subject, and I'm currently working on a project that discusses essentially the 1970s and the Equal Rights Amendment, hereafter the ERA, in which Zumwalt as CNO, Admiral Zumwalt as CNO at the time, and the other service chiefs also acknowledged the importance of the Equal Rights Amendment, which simply stated that women shall have equal social economic rights as men. That's a condensed version of it. And they genuinely thought that the ERA was going to pass Congress, because within 30 minutes of it making it through the House and the Senate, Hawaii was the first to ratify. It was very quick. So they were anticipating that this amendment was going to pass. And so going through Zumwalt's papers here on what we have here on the yard, I was shocked to find how quickly Zumwalt, in a Nixon-era presidency, was really instrumental in helping women to integrate more fully into the Navy. Women, of course, everything is incremental, right? So while the ERA intended that women should, you know, serve equally in the military, also serving on ships, it being the 1970s, there's the drawdown in Vietnam, there's concerns about women serving on ships. And come to find out, the ERA doesn't come to pass in the 1970s. In fact, it hasn't been enacted fully yet. However, the actions made by Zumwalt and his subordinates all throughout the Navy, you know, official administration could be seen as this moment of, you know, opening different service billets to women regardless of gender and regardless of race.
Yeah, that actually kind of reflects another period in time for women, mm-hmm. with the Naval Act of 1916, or Public mm-hmm. Law 241, where the Secretary of the Navy at the time, Josephus Daniels, realized, hey, there's now an opportunity where we're having a shortage of men joining the Navy.
Yeah.
We can now allow women to come in the Navy Reserves. And in essence, he has Rear Admiral Palmer, Chief of Bureau of Navigation, that by order of the SECNAV, he releases a memo to allow women to start getting into the yeoman ratings, the electrician ratings, and other ratings that the commandant may seem essential to the district organization. And by March 21st, 1917, you have Loretta Walsh, who's sworn in as a chief yeoman, mm-hmm. becoming the first female chief petty officer in the Navy.
Yeah, yeah. And these are, and in 1916, that is huge. for those listeners who are unfamiliar, the 19th Amendment, which grants women the right to vote, doesn't occur until 1920. So this individual who is, you know, serving the Navy, serving their country, is doing so without, you know, the full force of American citizenship. And that kind of draws into this idea of women having to demonstrate their, for lack of a better phrase, I don't want to say worth, but in that sense that they are worthy of this position, both in society, in the military, and they can do both. So as you discussed Petty Officer Lutz earlier about kind of the intersections of current events, contextualizing current events, you know, the rating Yeoman F in 1916 through 1918 through 1919 was met with some resistance by men, right? Because there was this idea that they would, one, be a distraction, because this would be the first time that women would be to some degree integrated into the force, despite being in very narrow billets, right? So in 1916 through 1919, women were secretaries, most notably nurses. In fact, women had been nurses unofficially in all services since the American Civil War. And even in the American Revolutionary War, very unofficially, women had served as what were called camp followers, you know, involved in washing clothing, mending, treating wounds, and also, you know, just cooking, you know, the basics of survival. But then we get to 1916 in this very integral moment in which there is a shortage of personnel. And I know this is, again, bringing the question you had asked earlier, Cliff, about why study women's history. This is yet again another moment in which the United States is struggling to recruit, whether it's because in 1916 we simply do not have enough Americans, or in today's case, we're trying to find ways and unique ways to recruit. And so one of the ways in which that is done is by recruiting women, by freeing up space for men to serve abroad to allow women into those either nursing spaces, which in some cases would bring them into spaces abroad, like in Pearl Harbor. These women are demonstrating how they can be of use to the service in much the same way that men would be doing simply by virtue of being men. And so it's a very interesting era to study.
In doing all the research for this podcast, one of the things I kind of realized is it's been a roller coaster ride. I would say at best, where you have the Civil War, women are needed, not in time of war, they're not needed. You've got pre-World War One, women are needed. Post-World War One, with the Yeoman Fs, they're said, hey, thank you, you're not needed anymore. And so you have this roller coaster of need, not need, need, not mm-hmm. need. Back into World War Two, you have the waves. The waves come in. So you have various men freeing up men for factory work. Correct. You've got the Rosie the Riveters that are going into the factories and doing that stuff so men can go down range and fight.
Correct. And speaking to that, much of the work that's been done, at least here with the command, I'm thinking of Dr. Gina Akers' work. She does mention how in World War One, there was, in addition to the clerks and the nurses and those involved in very early radio, there were a number of women who were asked by the government, recruited by the government to work in munitions factories, one of which is a former building we have here on the Washington Navy Yard, in which they would be constructing munitions and ordnance that would go abroad into Europe. And so in a very real and tangible way, these women were providing for the defense of the nation, for the defense of democracy abroad. So, but your point is well taken of the waves of need, I would guess. It goes to show the tenuousness, I think is a great word, of their role in the Navy and of the other services more broadly. I would also say that one of the fascinating points about World War One is that the Navy provided uniforms eventually. At first they did not. Women were wearing civilian clothes during training, and then they had a uniform designed, which was just a basic blouse, and then women were wearing their own dark colored skirts, which is why in photographs you probably can't really tell that they're likely all wearing a different skirt. But all of that is to say that this was a result of expediency, that the Navy needed to fill positions to free up men to go and serve abroad. And so they never saw it as permanent. So in 1919, women who were in the reserves, they were all reservists. They were thanked for their service, and some of them received benefits. Some of them, unfortunately, did not. And that was kind of a struggle towards the end of World War II in the benefits kind of area. I'm also thinking of the Hello Girls, which are the group of women in the Army who truly did serve abroad. They served in Europe, and they were responsible. They were the telegraph women who helped those who are serving on the ground in Europe get communications farther afield. So all of that is to say, it was your point is well taken, that there is a kind of a tenuousness at first for women's service.
Mm-hmm. And you kind of said how their role wasn't permanent, and it wasn't until 1948 when President Truman signed the Women Armed Services Integration Act, and that allowed women to serve permanently in the Army or Navy, right? So can you talk a little bit about the impact of those policies and regulations on women and their inclusion and treatment of them?
Yeah, so the Women's Armed Services Integration Act, as you mentioned, allowed women to serve permanently. So their role in World War II was very much akin to that of World War I in the sense that it was not deemed permanent. But then you have women like Joy Bright Hancock, who had served in World War I. She ended up working permanently, as was allowed. Some women were allowed to stay in the Navy as civilians. But of course, within that role, women were expected, if they were to be married, they had to leave the service, have their children until a certain point, and then come back into service, which is what Joy Bright Hancock did. And then ultimately in World War II, she sees a point of entry for women in the Bureau of Aeronautics. So she saw the Bureau of Aeronautics as the point through which women could, you know, eventually, hopefully open up the service to a number of other billets. She saw this as the avenue through which women could be most helpful to the Navy. And so the Bureau of Aeronautics, you know, opened mechanics positions to women and any number of piloting assistant programs. So when it came to the Women's Armed Services Integration Act, what I found interesting was it came in 1948 as we are knee-deep in demobilization, returning humans back from two fronts, along with all of the, you know, detritus from forwarding stations in the Pacific. And suddenly, women are allowed to serve in perpetuity, as are men of color, particularly African Americans. Both of those acts came about the same time. And so I found that really interesting, because there's also this push to allow, or encourage is a better word, encourage civilians to move out to the suburbs. And we think of the 1950s and the picket fences and the homes and Leave It to Beaver and all of that. So I found that really interesting that an act like that would pass. And come to find out, as we talked about a little bit before, much of that was with the push from Joy Bright Hancock, because she saw the Navy as a career for herself and undoubtedly for any number of other women. And of course, it was limited. Service was continued to be limited to shore duty, generally within, again, the Bureau of Aeronautics, nursing, secretarial work. There were some positions that were open to women in dispersing and mess halls and all of that. Generally, the billets that were open to women conformed with the kind of social expectations of women in the 1950s, that they were motherly, secretarial, teaching, things of that nature. However, this is the moment that women can serve in all branches of the military, again, in perpetuity, without having to be a reservist.
Nice. So you spoke about how those roles kind of, or how the careers in the Navy kind of fit with the what society expected of women, kind of confined them to that. So when in naval history for women did those roles start to change and those jobs start to change?
Yeah, so some could argue it's still happening. However, as we know, we have our first female CNO, and so that's wonderful. It was a slow roll, I would say. So in the 1970s, women are asking to serve on ships in the blue water, what we would call a blue water Navy, combatant ships. I'm thinking of Iona Owens. She ended up suing the United States Navy so that way she could serve on a ship, not necessarily for, you know, the experience of serving on a combatant ship, but because her billet was limited simply because of her her sex, she's as a woman.
When in naval history did women's roles or jobs start to change?
Well, one could really argue that billets, you know, occupations and roles for women have never really stopped changing, right? But as a historian, as I mentioned, of the Cold War and social movements of the 1970s, I would point to the efforts of Captain Joy Bright Hancock, her advocacy to make women's place in the Navy permanent, specifically right after World War II in the very early months of the Cold War. With the help of women in the other services, she slyly advocated to Admiral Chester Nimitz, who in turn spoke before Congress in a congressional hearing about incorporating women into the force permanently. And without getting into too much detail that would bore your listeners to death, the Women Armed Services Integration Act, we're going to call it WASIA, we love acronyms in the Navy, came into being in 1948, which made women a permanent presence in the armed forces, all branches of the armed forces. Now, if there's going to be a theme that we talk about today in this podcast, it's going to be incrementalism. That is a word. It's a word. So there were restrictions to WASIA, right? So, of course, women had to be of a certain age. And I also found it super interesting that the age was higher than that of men. So in 1948. So men could enlist at 18. Women had to be 20. And in some instances, needed a parent's authorization to do that. And so we can get into conversations about that in a little bit if that's something that intrigues you. So of course they had to, you know, be of a certain age, they had to be unmarried and without dependents, and we'll talk about that I think a little bit later on. But women could not serve whatsoever on blue water ships. So they were relegated to shore duties, and it wasn't, as I mentioned again, until the 1970s when that changed. When we're talking about women's roles in the Navy, there's a tendency to use the wave metaphor as one would for feminism, right? So that there's a lot of social change, there's a lot of policy change in the Navy, and then there's kind of like an ebb, or again, continuing with the metaphor, a doldrum, if you will, and then another wave. And so here is this doldrum after 1948, when it comes to WASIA, right? And so in the 1970s, there is an effort by prominent feminists to put forward what is known as the Equal Rights Amendment, which very simply just states that equality for rights under the law shall not be denied or abridged by the United States, you know, the federal government, or by any state on account of sex. That's all it says. And I cannot express to you in words how the service chiefs genuinely thought it would be ratified by the states quickly. So it goes through Congress in 1972, and it passes both the House and the Senate. It's sent off to the states for ratification. And within 30 minutes of that, Hawaii calls in and says, we ratify. So immediately the service chiefs, including CNO Zumwalt, Admiral Zumwalt, he immediately starts kind of going into, how can we get ahead of this? How can we make changes? Clearly, society is telling us changes should be made. How do we go about doing that? And the ERA had a deadline of March 1979 to be ratified by the states. And as some of us may know, the ERA did not pass the ratification process. However, Admiral Zumwalt issues ZGRAM for, again, listeners, ZGRAMs are those memos sent directly to the fleet, regardless of, you know, officer, enlisted, reservist. It is applicable to all service personnel, all sailors. And it helped, ZGRAM 116 in particular, helped open up a number of billets to women that were previously closed to them. As I mentioned earlier, incrementalism is the key here. And so, of course, it also reflects the times as well. So there was a concern. There's a drawdown in Vietnam. There's the all-volunteer force, which is also kind of coming into this calculus. And so Zumwalt, to kind of be middle of the road, says we're going to open up some IT billets to women. Unfortunately, that also meant that because of federal law, women were not allowed to serve on combatant vessels. So USS Sanctuary is a hospital ship in 1972, starts to incrementally integrate women. There were about 53 women assigned to USS Sanctuary, which was a hospital ship. And I think there were a number of officers as well into the teens who were also women officers who were assigned to Sanctuary. So that was kind of the testing ground. So the 70s is also this amazing moment in which substantial changes are made to women's positions. Again, incremental, but it's a start. The Yeoman F rating was temporary, not permanent. Roles were limited to shore duties in nursing or administrative work, like typing, dispersing, even teaching. And this implied that the Navy excluded women from certain physical spaces, right? Based on a perception of a woman's abilities. So a century later, in 2010, the Secretary of Defense, Robert Gates, lifted the ban on women in submarines, for example. This is a great example. The first women officers reported to Ohio-class ballistic missile submarines in 2011, and that was, what, 13 years ago? And so what is, as a historian, that leads me to a research question of what does that say about where civilian and Navy officials, again, at any time in American history, think women physically belong in the service. And so these are the research questions that get me, you know, really excited as a historian. And so thinking into the future, the Navy involves task forces, not just in operations abroad, but within the Bureau of Personnel. And so the Women in Submarine Task Force wants or has a goal of 33 different crews integrated with officers across all platforms, all home ports within the next 6 years by 2030. So these are really lofty goals and require the physical modification of space, right? And so they have to ensure that there's berthing spaces for men and women, which in 2024 requires even more conversations about where do we place them in berthing and so forth. So that's one of the aspects of the history of the Navy involving women that intrigues me about how space and occupation is related to a perception of anyone from anyone about a person's abilities and capabilities. So, yeah.
Yeah, that's super interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
Different way to think about it.
Absolutely, yeah.
Outside the box or outside the space thinking, right?
Yeah.
Exactly. All right, so how can discussing women's naval history help to empower or inspire women sailors?
discussing women sailors and their history, to be really blunt, just needs to happen. Especially when we talk about the intersections of womanhood. There are 160,000 women in the Navy at present, according to a memo we got not too long ago from Secretary Del Toro. 53% of that number are active duty. Let's not forget the 10% of the reservists. And then the remaining are civilians employed by the Navy, like myself. So within those numbers are intersections of race and sexuality, region of origin, and in some cases, national status for those who enlist as a path to American citizenship, which is another aspect that I would love to chat about. There's also class and education, and then, you know, the time that they want to be in service, right? There are some who see sailoring as temporary, you know, wait till my billet is up, while others find this a career, right? So the common denominator among all of that is that these women in the service chose to become involved with the Navy. So as a historian, I want to know why the Navy over the other services. In what era were, again, everything that we've talked about today is, you know, contextualizing the era in which these women are serving. So again, the ebb and the flow, the good and the bad, I want to know as a historian why some enlist when they do. And it is my hope that the history of the Navy, you know, however imperfect, is but one reason that women may find inspiration and empowerment. You know, there's certainly reasons why I, as a historian, gravitate to the 1970s, which you're probably gonna be tired of hearing me say, but it's because of the immense cultural, political, and policy shifts, again, incrementally, that, you know, benefited women sailors.
So I guess, lastly, are there any other things that you'd like to add or leave our listeners thinking about?
Yeah, I say we, historians, active duty sailors, officials, government officials as well, speak often about those foundational women who made great strides to break the glass ceiling, as it were. In June of 2022, for example, Lieutenant Commander Amanda Lee became the first woman pilot in the Blue Angels fighter jet demonstration squadron. In November of last year, Admiral Lisa Franchetti became the 33rd Chief of Naval Operations. And so these are it's still history, but it's very recent. And although we have a tendency to use the word trailblazer in these situations. And I'm going to admit on international airwaves that I loathe that word. And it occurs to me today why it kind of just irks me a little bit. And it's because these women did not join the Navy to be the first of X, Y, or Z billet or command. They're women sailors, each with specific talents and occupational interests. And the Navy was the vehicle through which they could make those aspirations come to fruition, right? So if I could leave your listeners, any active duty personnel, take it or leave it from a civilian, for anyone listening, a reservist as well, we won't forget you, know that your story, and since it's Women's History Month, your her story, if you will, it's your own. And a truly important one within the larger organization that is within the United States Navy.
Well, thank you so much again, Dr. Haley. I really enjoyed and appreciated listening to all the history that you shared with us.
Thanks for having me. It was wonderful.
Yeah, and to quickly recap, more information about women's history, photos, stories, oral histories, that can all be found on our website at history.navy.mil. Thanks for joining us today on this episode of Naval Women's History Month on Anchored in History, Stories of America's Navy.